When the credit rating agency Standard & Poor's, S&P, threatened a downgrade of long-term U.S. debt last week, Wall Street wobbled, Washington reactivated the debate over raising the debt ceiling. But then there was economic journalist Barry Ritholtz, who wrote on his blog, The Big Picture, "Who cares what S&P thinks? Didn't their business practices, along with those at Moody's and other ratings agencies, help create the great financial crisis?" He's referring to those great ratings the agencies gave to what turned out to be toxic, terrible financial instruments. Well, we had been wondering, where are we on the pledges of reform at the credit rating agencies? So we decided to bring in Jesse Eisinger, a senior reporter for the independent nonprofit newsroom ProPublica, to take a look. And Jesse, is it true that you're wearing your recent Pulitzer Prize that you just won? As you join us?
They don't give the medal of the sash yet.
Oh, so I didn't know. I thought perhaps you were wearing it as a necklace. You won it with Jake Bernstein for your reporting on Wall Street practices that led to the financial crisis. You are the recipient of the first fully online Pulitzer, so congratulations.
Thank you so much.
But having done this work, let's start with your overview. The ratings agencies accused of being too cozy with the banks that paid them. You know, the agencies were paid by the banks to rate the financial instruments of the banks. So that charge of being too cozy, has that changed?
It doesn't look like it's changed that much. There was a big law, Dodd-Frank, that was passed to try to reform the rating agencies, but a lot of that is delayed. It's not being funded, and some of that was on hold, some of the key provisions. And then the culture at the actual rating agencies doesn't seem to have changed much at all. In fact, they sort of see themselves as victims of the financial crisis, and they say, well, we may have made a little mistake in, you know, stuff that was related to housing, just the structured finance area, but everything else is fine. And so, you know, here we are several years on after the financial crisis, and not much has changed.
Well, they may have been victims in one way of one of the criticisms of the setup, which is that often the banks knew more than they did about the instruments. But as far as the culture, you recently spoke with Bill Harrington, a former analyst at Moody's for more than a decade. What did he tell you about this sort of the culture, the ethos?
Yeah, that was very interesting. Bill had worked there about a decade, and then he left last year. And he said that in that decade, he saw a total transformation of the culture from a place that had almost worked like an academic setting where these guys would get together in committees and really deliberate carefully over the ratings, to a place where the ratings had become very corrupted by the bankers. And in fact, the bankers really ran the show. If the bankers abused the analysts or tried to get the analysts to see it their way, the analysts might be moved off a rating and another friendlier analyst would be there. And it was a culture of real customer service for the banks. And of course, the banks are the ones that are paying for the ratings. They're paying for the creation of they create the structured finance instrument, and then the rating agencies rate it, and the banks pay for that. So, of course, it's in the bank's interest to get a better rating for it, and they bully the rating agencies and get them to rate it more highly. And, of course, it's in the rating agency's interest to listen to the banks because the banks are paying
them. And the banks are accused of doing things like rating shopping, you know, finding the agency that would give them the better rating. But when you asked Moody's about Bill Harrington's experiences, and, you know, he also told you that when he delayed returning a call to a bank for a day or so, he got a call from his boss saying he'd, got a call from another, you know, head of compliance at Moody's, wanting to know why he hadn't returned the banker's call. So he felt that the pressure of the culture was to respond to the customer, that the customer service was job number one, I think he said. And, of course, the customers were the bankers.
Exactly. And, you know, that's a very telling anecdote because a compliance director is supposed to be looking after the sanctity of the ratings. They're not supposed to be looking after how the customer, the bankers, are being served by the analysts. The analysts are in this really untenable position where they have to both analyze the instrument that the bankers are setting in front of them and also try to serve their needs, the bankers' needs, because the bankers are the customers. And so you would want the compliance officer to protect the analysts and protect the integrity of the process. Instead, in this case, Harrington felt like the compliance director was coming down on the side of the bankers against him, and he really felt compromised by that. I don't think he compromised the integrity of his own analysis, but he felt that there was pressure there, and I think a lot of analysts feel that there's pressure there.
Well, it's key. I want to keep what you just said. He didn't compromise, but he felt the pressure to compromise. Just keep that thought for a second, but I just want to pick up. Moody's strongly objected to your characterization of Bill Harrington's experiences. They don't agree.
Right. And this has been a theme that they have echoed throughout the postmortems on the financial crisis. Ray McDaniel, the CEO, who is still there after being at the helm throughout the financial crisis, he gave testimony to the Angelides Commission, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. And essentially his argument is, look, we made a mistake. We made a little mistake in this small area of housing-related structured finance, but we still rate muni bonds well. We still rate sovereign debt well, from the United States government, as you mentioned at the top there. And so that argument is disingenuous at best, because structured finance was a disproportionately profitable area. It was the fastest growing area. It's the area that they put the most resources and attention to. It was really the heart of the company for a while during the boom, and it was a complete and utter disaster and has really destroyed their reputation. But their reputations have managed to the business has managed to survive the reputational hit, which is almost inexplicable, but it's astonishing but true.
Well, we're going to hear some more about that, but we also heard from one of our listeners, Bill Chambers. He's now associate professor at Boston University, where we call home, but he worked for 22 years at S&P, Standard & Poor's, and he says he's not an apologist in any way for the industry. He said there are some problems. But it's one thing to be responsive to the banking industry, another to make that rating. And he says, in all the agencies, there's a firewall, he says, between the revenue side, the one taking in these fees from the banks, and the ratings side. And he said every agency he knew, just like you mentioned, Bill Harrington felt pressure but didn't adjust his rating. He said every agent he knew had this fierce pride in getting it right.
Yeah, well, that may be his experience. I've never spoken to him, but the testimony from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and the Levin Commission under oath from multiple former executives of the rating agencies testified the opposite, which was that there was a lot of mingling between the sales and the ratings culture, that the ratings agencies couldn't say no to a deal. They never had the power to walk away from a deal because they were so worried about market share. And so they would lean over backwards to give the banks what they wanted. And the proof is in the pudding. There was a complete and utter breakdown of every methodological analytical tool that they used for the ratings, and they lost investors billions
of dollars. Jesse Eisinger of ProPublica. We're going to have more after a break here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our look at ratings agencies. These are the firms that rate a range of financial instruments created by the banks that pay the agencies to rate them. We're talking with Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter for the independent nonprofit newsroom ProPublica. He and Jake Bernstein just won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting for their series on Wall Street practices. A perfect person to dive into this. And Jesse, you were, we were just talking about people we've heard from, listeners who've worked at agencies who said they never would, they had great pride in getting the ratings right. But on the other hand, you spoke to a former agent who felt great pressure to bend it to the will of the bank. But that brings us, who pays whom for these? Let's get some history. As we've been saying, right now the banks pay S&P, Moody's, to make these ratings. And as the New York Times' Eric Dash said, that's like a Hollywood studio paying movie critics for a review. But it wasn't always that way. Who did pay the agencies?
Well, originally, it was paid by the investors themselves, who used the ratings to make a determination on the bonds that they bought. Moody's created ratings to rate railroad bonds originally, I believe in the 20s. And so for many decades, that was the model that was used. But it was inherently problematic because it was determined that a rating was essentially a public good that deserved a wider audience. And you couldn't really keep it secret. So the investor might pay for it, but then it would just be publicized. And the investor was sort of there were a lot of freeloaders who could just buy the bond based on the rating.
Well, especially in the 70s when photocopying came around and then everybody could just copy it and send it around. So that's when it started switching and the agency started charging the banks for the rating and then it got publicized. And of course, the government steps in and mandates a handful of ratings agencies as nationally recognized. And then the whole system changed. But that brings us up to the recent crisis and some efforts at reform. What were the two main suggestions of reform and what happened to them?
Well, the big thing is that the SEC now is mandated to create an office of rating agencies where they're going to actually oversee the rating agencies and judge the practices based on their accuracy, their integrity, this kind of thing, oversee how the ratings agencies work. And the second thing is that they're now liable for their opinions, or in theory, they're supposed to be liable for their opinions, that if they put them into official documents like prospectuses. So they'll be treated just like lawyers or accountants. The problem is that the SEC immediately suspended this liability after Dodd-Frank passed it, because there was some sort of ripple in the bond markets. The bond markets kind of balked at this, and everybody got worried that the agencies would actually have liability. The agencies, of course, don't want to have liability. They believe that they're just expressing their opinions, which is really not an argument that stands up to any scrutiny.
But good.
Sure. The other problem is that the money that the SEC needs to fund this office hasn't been allocated and probably won't be. So it's looking very grim for both those reforms.
And yet, while those two proposals of the Dodd-Frank law are on hold, you write that this isn't just something that happened way back when. That Standard & Poor's put out a news release just this December that it was going to lower ratings on 1,200 complex mortgage securities. But two-thirds of those had been rated in 2010. So they were admitting now that there was a mistake, just last year. In other words, a lot of these old, terrible financial instruments with some terrible mortgages in them are being repackaged and put out and given high ratings again.
Yes, the S&P just got through a round post-financial crisis of misrating, misunderstanding the basic structure of thousands, billions of dollars worth of bonds that had been rated largely in 2010, as you just said. These were housing-related bonds, complicated structures called re-REMICs. They were essentially repackages of bonds that had already collapsed. And S&P didn't understand the basic way that the money was supposed to flow through these structures. And if they're not getting that right, then you have to really wonder what they're doing right at all.
Well, given that, and you can't sort of cherry pick when you want to listen to a rating agency because maybe it's politically appealing to you. I'm thinking of the recent S&P rating of U.S. Treasury bonds or threatening to lower their rating in the future. And people who are for raising the debt or not against raising the debt ceiling jumped all over So what do we do? Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank, of course, he of the Frank Dodd bill, told Gretchen Morgenson of the New York Times, maybe just eliminate investor reliance on ratings. How do you do that? Just Jesse Eisinger, your thoughts on what can possibly happen?
Well, they've tried to do that. They've tried to excise ratings from any new laws that are passed. It's extremely difficult. And the problem is that the rating agencies aren't in themselves so powerful. It's that they're protected by Wall Street because the Wall Street banks don't want to go out and have to sell a municipal bond to your grandmother and have to explain everything to her about that bond and make sure that she understands it and she's qualified. So they use the ratings as a proxy for it. So it would be enormously expensive. It would take enormous amount of time and resources to sell bonds from Germany and bonds from some municipality and bonds from GE and IBM and those kind of things without the ratings. So the ratings are a convenience. Of course, it's a convenience that protects us from our laziness and our inability really to analyze this stuff well. And so it's a convenience that we are all paying for that unfortunately doesn't work that well.
Well, and to be continued. Jesse Eisinger, a senior reporter for the nonprofit ProPublica, taking a look at ratings agencies. And once again, Jesse, congratulations on your recent Pulitzer Prize for your past look at Wall Street practices. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me.
Okay. Be back. We have the latest news coming up here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.